Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's a pleasure for me to give this presentation at this meeting. I'm grateful to the organizers for including me, and it's also a topic that's extremely important and relevant for our work at Erie. In terms of the green revolution in rice, I think this was dependent quite a bit, as most people know, on the semi-dwarfing gene FT1, which was discovered in the Chinese variety Diji Wujin and transferred into the high-yielding tropical varieties like IR8, originally PETA. And I'm going to emphasize the tropical rice in my talk, which is where we see a lot of the poverty and which was the original focus of the first Green Revolution. Of course, the Green Revolution has occurred in all kinds of rice, but for us at Erie, we've put a lot of emphasis on tropical rice. And then, of course, the development of high-yielding varieties was a critical factor. These high yields were, of course, accompanied by an increase in inputs, which led to higher yield. And again, as I mentioned, that was based on largely on the FT1 gene, the semi-dwarfing gene, which allowed the plant to become more efficient at partitioning the starch to the grains. And then I also want to mention that there were quite a number of other traits that were involved with development of these high-yielding varieties that contributed to their success and adoption. They include particularly disease and insect resistance, short duration, and improved quality. So those were very important in the spread and the usefulness of these varieties, but I'm not going to emphasize very much on those traits in this talk. Now, I mentioned that Erie has particularly strong focus on poverty, and this is just a poverty map showing dots where where there's 100,000 people living on less than $1 a day. And it's interesting to see that that it almost looks to some extent like a map of rice production, especially in Asia. So based on the estimate, we have about 70% of those people are in Asia, and most of these are rice producers or consumers. So it does show the importance of rice as a means to address the issue of poverty. Now, recently, Erie has joined with our partner institutes, Africa Rice and CIOT, to launch what we call the Global Rice Science Partnership, or GRISP. And so we're trying to harmonize our activities and our programs across these three institutes and three continents. The main themes that we're working on are harnessing genetic diversity, accelerating varietal and germplasm development, increasing the productivity of rice systems, post-harvest and value-added products, improved policies and technology targeting, and supporting the growth of the global rice sector. So this new program addresses all the aspects of rice production and development. However, my talk is going to be focusing, as for the theme of this symposium, on the varietal improvement part, which we call theme two in the new GRISP program. Now, I use the word plural intentionally in my title because I think there are different types of green revolutions which are in fact can occur independently of each other, but which would all contribute to the development of improved varieties and solving the problems of rice in the world. I'm going to focus on three of them. First one is on increasing yield potential, which is the one which we most often think about for a green revolution. The second is on improved nutritional quality, and the third one on rice in unfavorable environments. The first two, in fact, of course, apply to all the areas, so they would also, of course, apply to the rice in unfavorable environments. And just to emphasize again that we need to, of course, maintain and enhance other traits like disease and insect resistance, as well as grain quality. So although I'm not going to cover those, I think those are very important for the success of all these kind of efforts. Now, first, the first one, increasing yield potential. Of course, the problem is that we have a kind of yield plateau for tropical rice, and so we haven't really been able to push up yield potential for quite some time since the development of the major summit dwarf varieties that have been spreading. So we're looking at three different areas of focus for this work. One is on increasing the yield of the inbred varieties, inbreds meaning the normal rice varieties, because most of them are inbreds, and so we need to look at ways to increase their yield potential. The second one is on exploiting hybrid rice and the heterosis, especially the heterosis you can see between the different subspecies of rice, which lead to higher yields. And so there's quite a bit of work that's been going on, especially in China, on developing higher-yielding rice varieties through hybrid rice, and we're trying to spread that as well to the tropical conditions. The third one is on C4 rice, making a C4 rice plant, and I'm not going to cover that for two reasons. One is because it's not really breeding, and secondly, I didn't want to answer any questions on that, so I'll leave that out of the talk. Now, in terms of increasing yield potential, of course, we've recognized this as a problem for a long time in rice. In fact, we started a project around 1990, what we called the new plant type, and to my dismay, other people called the super rice. But this has been going on for quite a long time at Erie. And I think originally the feeling was that through making a more efficient rice plant type, which had larger panicles, less unproductive tillers, and traits like that, that we could increase the yields by as much as 20% over the existing indica, indica being the tropical rice subspecies. Now, we haven't got that 20% yield increase, I think I can say. Even in plants which kind of look like what was envisioned as the new plant type. But what I wanted to just emphasize is that we have got a lot of interesting and useful germplasm from that project. That project involved using tropical japonica germplasm and intercrossing that with indica germplasm, which hadn't been done too much with rice by rice breeders. And so there have been some varieties that have come out of that program which are doing quite well. I mentioned one released in the Philippines. And we actually think that going forward, with some modifications slight change of focus, that we can revive some of that work to address the area of increasing yield potential. But we are looking at many other things, not only looking at the plant type traits, but also at breeding methods like recurrent selection and better phenotyping and so forth. So we're going to probably start a newer project soon that gives a higher attention to breeding for this higher yield potential as opposed to just incremental changes in the improved varieties. Now, for hybrid rice, it's been extremely successful in a few places, namely China, which is about half area under hybrid rice, and also in the U.S., where hybrid rice is expanding very rapidly. It hasn't been nearly as successful in the tropics, where indica rice is grown. But I wanted to mention that there are a number of varieties that have been developed. These are some of the ones released by from Erie's breeding program in the Philippines. And this is some data from India showing the yield gain and the income increase by farmers growing hybrid rice. It's a bit misleading. It doesn't mean to say that we get about 30% yield increase in hybrids. This is just yields of what the farmers are getting. So it involves every aspect of the production, including the management and so forth. The reality is that in the tropical condition, we don't see, probably at the moment, we don't see enough heterosis that really makes it break even. It's about 10% perhaps, but it's going up. And I think with the progress that I see at least, I think that's going to go up and be competitive. So it'll take a little bit longer. There are a few examples of some hybrids that seem to be very successful in getting higher levels of heterosis. So, but at the moment, on the average, I'd say we still have a ways to go. And part of the reason for that is I think that the germplasm that's being used is not yet optimized, I think, for producing the highest yielding hybrid. So that's what we're working on at Erie now. The second one I wanted to talk about, second area, is on nutrition. And the work that we're doing on nutrition is focused on the poor rice consumers again. So we're looking mainly at micronutrient deficiencies, and the main ones are vitamin A deficiency, iron deficiency, and zinc deficiency. And if you look at iron and zinc, we had planned originally that these would be the main focus in the non-transgenic approaches. This table shows that the baseline levels for the common rice varieties that we have are quite low. For zinc, 16 parts per million, and then for iron, 2.5. The current levels that we have in the breeding program are 24 and 8. So, and then the target levels are 24 and 14 for zinc and iron. So you can see for zinc, we have reached the target level. For iron, we haven't. And there's a serious constraint for increasing the iron density in that most of the iron occurs in the outer layers of the grain, and that those layers are removed during milling. And so we're having a really difficult time getting the iron level to acceptable level to reach the target. But for zinc, we think that there are varieties that will be coming online that will have those high zinc levels. These show some of the best lines that we have for the high zinc level, and so they're much better than the popular varieties. So for iron, it looks like we're still trying to increase the levels, but I'm not sure if we'll be able to get that there by just using the non-transgenic methods. For vitamin A, of course, we're using the transgenic approach, and we have the golden rice, which is dependent on two genes introduced into rice that allow it to produce beta carotene in the grains. And we have four varieties now which are under field tests. So we're hopeful that we could release some of these at least in about a two-year, three-year time level. But it really depends on a lot of things beyond our control at ERIE. I mean, we have a network of partners dealing with this, and of course there are many issues like regulatory issues that have to be solved, but it's moving forward, and it looks like the progress has been quite good in that project. Now, I'd like to switch now to my last main topic on rain-fed rice, and the one which has been really personally more interesting for me. That's where I've been spending most of my time, so I'll put a little bit more attention to this area. And it's also the area where we are really seeing quite good progress so far. Now, if you go back a few years, we had a strategic planning exercise in 2005 where we had an expert panel assembled at ERIE, and one of the things this panel said was, you know, ERIE should really have a big project to double the yields of rain-fed rice, which is quite an ambitious undertaking. Of course, the yields in rain-fed areas have not really increased in any way like what we see in the irrigated areas, and so they're quite low. So this is quite an ambitious project which ERIE was asked to take up. And if you look at the yield gaps in these different areas, in fact, if you look at the favorable areas, a lot of that yield gap, the existing yield gap, is on management of the crop, how it's managed. You have high-yielding varieties already that do very well, but the farmers may not be getting the full advantage. And so it really takes improvements in agronomy and how these are managed. In the case of unfavorable areas, germplasm is actually a much more serious limitation because these varieties do not have the tolerance to the various stresses that occur in the rain-fed areas. So it means that perhaps we can say that for the unfavorable areas, variety and varietal improvement is probably a more important contribution. Despite the fact that we've been working on this for quite a long time, we've had fairly limited impact in improving yields. In fact, if you look at the varieties the farmers are growing in rain-fed areas, mostly they are varieties developed for favorable condition and that have just spread over to the non-favorable or the irrigated areas, the rain-fed areas. Or they may be growing some of their traditional varieties that have more tolerance to these stresses. But for improved stress-tolerant varieties, these have not had much impact so far. So, as I mentioned, one of the real challenges for addressing or creating a green revolution for these unfavorable environments is really to address these abiotic stresses. Water shortage, of course, is probably the major one. and water shortage reduces the yields and also reduces the area of rice transplanted. Flooding is another major one. Short-term submergence damages or destroys the crop completely, and longer-term flooding, that's usually what we call stagnant or partial flooding, reduces the yield potential in large areas. Adverse soils like salinity, alkalinity, and different kinds of toxicities or deficiencies reduce yields a lot in these areas. And, of course, temperature extremes. Mainly, at the moment, low temperature, but, of course, high temperature is becoming an increasing problem. We have a large project which we developed about 3 years ago, which we call STRASA. It's Stress-Tolerant Rice for Africa and South Asia. This is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this project has really kind of brought together a lot of the work that has been going on for such a long time, but has not achieved that much impact, in which we are expecting actually to achieve impact in the short term. And in fact, within the 3 years of this project already, we've had a lot of success in terms of dissemination of some of the varieties that have been developed. But this project focuses on five major abiotic stresses. Drought, submergence, and salinity are the main ones which we work on in Asia, mainly at Erie. And then iron toxicity and low temperature have been added on because these are very significant problems in Africa. And so the Africa part of this project is coordinated by Africa Rice, which used to be called WARDA, for those of you who aren't familiar with that yet. So I think there are two ingredients to making a lot of progress in the unfavorable environments. One is that there are widely grown what we call mega varieties that are grown in large areas in these environments. And these varieties are intolerant of abiotic stresses, but otherwise they have good yield potential and good grain quality. So we think these are a good vehicle for actually introducing stress-tolerant varieties. And the second ingredient is that abiotic stress tolerance in rice is very often conferred by major QTLs. So it means that we can actually have QTLs or major genes that can significantly increase the level of stress tolerance. This is an example of a mega variety, Swarna, developed about 25, I think it's over 25 years ago in India, in Maratero, India, and now spread on very large area. Probably this one variety covers around 6 million hectares of rice production, especially in eastern India, Bangladesh, and Nepal. And many of these areas are the ones which have the most frequent occurrence of stresses like drought and submergence. It has many desirable characteristics which has really led to its popularity, like high yield, stable yield, even under lower fertility, good quality, good brand characteristics. It's tolerant to delayed transplanting, and it fits well into the existing cropping systems. In addition to that, it is susceptible to every abiotic stress. So really, it's an ideal way to try to introduce these traits because it is so popular, it is so susceptible, it gives us a chance to make really an impact in this area. Now, combined with that, we also have these large QTLs. Sub 1 is the one that is probably the most advanced example and also the biggest effect. So this one, it started as a QTL, but of course now we treat it as a major gene. It really has a big effect on survival after submergence. And so just by this one gene alone, we can make a significant impact. In the case of drought, we have also some good candidate QTLs. They are not as big as sub 1, but if you combine a few of these, you can actually get quite significant effect of stress tolerance. With 2 to 3 of them, you can get, in fact, a one-time yield advantage under situation where your yield of the control variety is only about half a ton. So it has quite huge benefit under those situations. With salinity, we also have the same thing. This is a variety, a gene we call Taltal, a QTL, which also has a big effect under salinity. Now, in terms of our breeding on these three major stresses, we now have varieties for all the that are tolerant of all these stresses and that are being disseminated. So we're very fortunate that we've had good success for these three major stresses. This is an example for drought. This is a variety released in the Philippines that has drought tolerance, and a sister line was released in India, Sabagidan. And that variety is as I mentioned, is giving quite significant yield advantage under drought over IRC54, which is the widely grown variety in that area. So now we're widely disseminating this through our Strasa project in India and Nepal, and we hope soon in Bangladesh. For salinity, we have the same kind of varieties. These are, the one on the upper right is a variety which is spreading on, you can see on the left of that levee, compared to the one on the right affected by salinity. That's being spread in eastern India. The one below that is spreading in Bangladesh. So these varieties are already released and approved by governments, and they're under wide-scale dissemination. And the sub-1 varieties are a bit different because, as I mentioned, we use the sub-1 gene and we incorporated that through marker-assisted backcrossing. So we basically want to end up with a variety that looks exactly like the original, but which has that trait added on. So they have all the characteristics of the popular varieties. This means that they can be rapidly evaluated. Most of the countries now accept about 2 years of data for these kind of varieties. The objective really is to replace the original varieties. And so it means they have a kind of fast-track system for releasing and disseminating these varieties rapidly to the farmers. This is an example of Swarna sub-1. On the left, the typical situation is after transplanting, there's a flood, it destroys the farmer's crop, and if it didn't happen too late, they have a chance that they might be able to go back and replant if they can find some seedlings. But then they suffer from reduced yields as well as labor problems. Now you could see with this example that this is the same field on August 31st, just after the flood, and October 31st. So the recovery is spectacular of this variety after flooding. You could see it closely here that it's actually starting to regrow a few days after flooding, and then by October 31, it looks like a normal crop. It produced about 4 tons, which is a pretty normal yield for Swarna. So it shows you the ability of this crop to survive flooding. If you look at this side, this is actually a seedbed. So a seedbed is just, you know, they plant that there before they transplant. And normally they don't get flooding in the seedbed because they usually plant it on an area that's not as much, not a low-lying area. But this seedbed was flooded in India, and the Swarna sub-1 with the yellow arrow is doing fine, and so they'll be able to transplant that. But the normal varieties are almost gone. And then even at after panicle initiation, we have here, this variety is Swarna, and this is Swarna sub-1. So this crop was hit by flooding after panicle initiation, but before flowering. And we actually thought that that probably wouldn't have much benefit, but you could see that they basically got no panicles in the Swarna, and they got about a 3-ton crop in the Swarna sub-1. So it's a very good gene in that sense. It can be used widely in different growth durations. To try to disseminate this in a faster way, we are trying to target the dissemination to the areas most prone to flooding. So we're using some satellite data on flooding areas. And then when we get a map, this is a map of Bihar state in India. We overlay that on the village map and the rice map. And then we end up with a list of villages which are subjected to submergence on a wider basis. And so for each of these villages, they will be just given by the Indian government 5 kilogram samples to test the Swarna sub-1 variety. In addition to that, we also work directly with NGOs for dissemination of these varieties on a more local level. These NGOs work directly with certain villages, and so they give us a kind of long-term view and how the varieties perform and also help spread the varieties. And that creates a kind of awareness also among other areas, other farmers. So these are 2 examples, Grameen Development Services in Bihar and Solidarity in Bangladesh, but there are many of these organizations that we've been working with on our Strasa project. And this slide just shows you the kind of scale that we're working with in this project for dissemination of stress-tolerant varieties. So this is the plan of the state government of UP in India to disseminate Swarna sub-1. And they started with, in 2010, with about 1,500 hectares. And so by 2012, they want to produce 25,000 tons of seed, and this would be about 5.5 million hectares. And I put a question mark here. Actually, they had 1 million hectares. So they want to have 1 million hectares of this variety by 2013. That would be basically the entire area subject to submergence. And I can't see how they could actually do it, but this just shows you the ambition they have and the scale of the operation. They really, and this is only one state, so all the states now are looking at a similar kind of program to rapidly disseminate these varieties. I didn't show the yield data, by the way, but I, as I mentioned, you can usually get, when you have flooding, you get about a 1 to 2 time yield advantage with using the sub-1 gene. And so with all these stresses, we seem to be getting this kind of benefits. So as a conclusion, I just wanted to mention that, as I indicated earlier, high yield potential is really necessary to maintain the rice supply for future population increases and maintaining profitability of rice farming. It's an area which is extremely challenging, and so I can't say that we have a real answer for that now, but it's something that's really important that needs to be addressed. I think nutritional biofortification is coming along quickly, so we hope that we'll have products in the near future that will address these poor rice consumers who eat so much rice that really they have, that this large amount of rice they consume actually is one of the reasons why they have these problems of micronutrient deficiencies. And this is, of course, biofortification of rice is not the only solution or the main, there are other things that have to be done, but we do think this has a role. And finally, higher yields in unfavorable environments, especially tolerant to abiotic stresses, will bring the benefits of the Green Revolution to rain-fed farmers, and this is one which, I mentioned, is already occurring on a fairly large scale. One real advantage of the partnership that we have now with Africa Rice in our projects is that we hope that we can actually extend a lot of the benefits that we're seeing in the stress tolerance across continents. So we're really hoping that this may bring the first Green Revolution of rice in Africa, and rice is one of the most rapidly expanding crops in sub-Saharan Africa. So we feel this is one of the really good outcomes that we have of this project. Before I close, just I want to thank some of the individuals at ERIE who provided slides for my presentation. Thank you very much.